Hello, welcome to And Another Thing. I'm Dara Kennedy. The Tanglewood Festival closed last summer for the first time since 1943. That meant the cancellation of nearly 150 Boston Symphony Orchestra Tanglewood concerts, all due to the coronavirus outbreak. Now, the Berkshires are back to the business of entertaining, and the Boston Pops are ready to own their Friday festival performances.
I'm Maya Schwader. At the helm of the festivities is Maestro Keith Lockhart, who's been leading the Pops since 1995. With Tanglewood reopening, we wanted to know, how does it feel to return? How do the Pops hold it together during quarantine? And maybe, what does his future hold? To join our conversations, you can reach us at andanotherthing@nepm.org or across social platforms, we are at Hello and Another.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Dara Kennedy. The conductor of the Boston Pops has led over 2,000 shows since he succeeded six decades of direction under John Williams. In our Monday conversation, the Boston Pops maestro Keith Lockhart discusses his personal difficulties during the almost two-year hiatus, and he tells And Another Thing if a new album is on the horizon. Spoiler alert, it could include your favorite pop stars.
I'm Maya Schwader. When the Boston Symphony and the Boston Pops announced that they would be back at Tanglewood this summer, it was the sweetest music to the ears of all of us classical music fans. After all, it's been more than a year of no performances, no gigs, and no live shows. Now, just as our region's favorite festival and favorite Pops orchestra are getting back together, we got the chance to chat with Maestro Keith Lockhart, and we had so many questions about how an orchestra survives quarantine, how classical music survives quarantine, and what he's learned in a year away from the podium. Maestro Lockhart joins us now.
You are opening the season at Tanglewood. How does that feel after a year of being away?
Well, it has all come flooding back in a big hurry, and I'm still pinching myself to make sure that it's real. We actually opened the Pops participation at Tanglewood with the 4th of July concert, moved out there because of COVID this past July 4th. And the Boston Symphony has been here playing 2 weeks of concerts under the stars at Tanglewood for a crowd, and I understand under the rain at Tanglewood a little bit too. But this is the first Pops concert during the Tanglewood season. It still feels very different to be performing for audiences after 15 or 16 months away.
Well, Tanglewood is open, but at 50% capacity. So I guess that's what, approximately 9,000 people. Does that bother you to only have half of the crowd that we saw in the festivals pre-pandemic?
Well, you know, having seen zero crowd for a year and a half, seeing 9,000 people is still pretty impressive. I mean, the great thing about Tanglewood is that, yes, I think, you know, the municipalities are being cautious and easing back into this. But since it is such a large shed and such a large capacity lawn, we can still service not everybody we'd like to, but a big percentage of our population that comes to these concerts. The oddest thing, I think, honestly, was doing the 4th of July concert for only 9,000 people when we're used to doing it for 400,000 people.
Being a musician in quarantine for the past year and a half, when you don't have the next concert, the next gig to practice for, how do you keep yourself sharp as an artist and as a conductor?
Well, it's a difficult question. I'm sure everybody has a slightly different answer to it. I have to say, number one, being a musician in quarantine, being a performing artist where your whole job, your whole responsibility, your whole life is about making music for other people is bad enough. But being a conductor under those circumstances is even worse, because a conductor, of course, really has nothing to do in quarantine that involves conducting. Because conducting involves getting a lot of people together and making something greater than the sum of its parts. I think most of us, for me, it meant going back to my instrument, back to the piano and playing more, because I needed to find a way to express myself somewhat. But in terms of studying new projects, things like that, I'd like to say that I used the time really productively, but no, I didn't use the time musically very productively. I did use it doing a lot of dad things, because I have a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old at home, and we got to know each other far better than we've ever known each other at any moment in their lives.
Now in your 25th season as the Boston Pops conductor, how has this journey changed the way that you perform? That's the second longest tenure in the Boston Pops history.
That is. This is this actually, yes, it would have been last year. 2020 would have been my 25th anniversary season, actually my 26th year here. So it's a little confusing now as to how many years it is. But yes, it is the longest tenure in the history of the Boston Pops, which dates back now 131 years, something like that, the longest tenure was Arthur Fiedler, who died in his 50th year. Then mine is next at a mere 25 years, and John Williams is at 13 years after that. So it has been such the central part of my life for so many years now, and to have that taken away, plus every other opportunity for musical expression, has been something that I never thought would happen. And I don't think anybody in any walk of life thought this is what was going to happen to the world over the last year and a half. But it's really, one thing I can tell you is that one thing that's really exciting is that audiences that we've seen are so hungry for in-person communication, for this sense of congregation and community, that it's like everything we do is a rock concert, and that's kind of exciting.
When it came time to start rehearsing for this next series of concerts, how do you deal with COVID safety in an orchestral setting? Some instruments you can have a mask on, but there's a large section of instruments where you have to have your mouth exposed and have to be blowing air. How do you handle that?
Well, that's true. We have a lot of aerosol producers. Well, it's all been, during the time, during the lockdown and shortly after that, we did a whole year of virtual performances where the orchestra worked together to produce programs that were then shown online. Both the Pops and the Boston Symphony participated in that. We did probably 20 weeks of them. And we had a 60-page protocol for how the orchestra was going to do that in terms of how far people were away from each other while warming up. On stage, we basically extended the stage in Symphony Hall in Boston to about twice its normal size. And we had all the aerosol producing, that's the winds and brass players, playing 10 feet apart from any other person. And the string players and others who could mask were masked and 6 feet apart. So it was a very, very stretched out orchestra, which provided some challenges, as well. With the reopening of Tanglewood and the reopening of public concerts, we have relaxed those restrictions a bit. We're still being very cautious, but we have an entirely vaccinated orchestra, and we're comfortable going ahead with what we're going ahead with. But there's still a couple things in place, like we're not doing any vocal music on stage with the orchestra yet, and that will come back certainly by this fall. And we're like everybody else, we're following the CDC guidelines and hoping that everybody gets vaccinated and we can put this thing behind us.
Have you wondered where the Boston Pops name came from? Well, it was derived from its original title, indicating lighter shows. In the 1800s, it was called the Promenade Concerts, which turned into Popular Concerts, which today is shortened to Pops. As the name has evolved, has the actual genre and popularity?
Some people have said that classical music is dying. As festivals reopen and people come back together, are you noticing a difference in the person that attends these concerts?
Well, people have said that classical music is dying for about 125, 130 years now, ever since pretty much the beginning of the 20th century. And somehow the rumors of our death have always seemed a little bit exaggerated, as it turned out. It is one thing that we noticed with our virtual presence, our online presence this year, is that we had a lot of people. We put it out there because we wanted our constituency, the people who normally come and hear us, to stay in contact with us. But what we found were there are a lot of people who don't come to concerts, who took advantage of the online offerings. And I think one of the challenges going forward, it's too early for me to tell who's back in the audience. Certainly a lot of people who this was a big part of their lives and were hungry to return to it. But I'm hoping that some of those people who fell in love with what we do by seeing us online will understand how much more impactful the experience is in person, and that this will actually, in some strange way, obviously there's going to be all of our performing arts organizations have taken some level of damage as a result of this. So coming back out of it is going to be slow, but it would really be wonderful if it had actually brought forward a whole new potential audience. One of the things is that I think performing arts organizations need to be much more involved in outreach in the greatest possible sense, including music education, because one of the things that has caused a thinning out of classical music audiences is the lack of music education in so many schools these days. And you can just see if you look at the participants in the classical music scene, the places, the people who come into our fold are people with extensive music education backgrounds, who learned an instrument in school, who played in the marching band, who played in the orchestra, and come out of it with a real appreciation of this sort of thing. It's hard to come out of it with an appreciation if you've never been exposed.
Just to follow up on that, how then can it become more inclusive, right? I think only 1.8% of musicians in American orchestras are Black, and only 4.3% of the conductors are. So as you're educating on the music, are you also opening doors for inclusivity within the orchestra?
Well, obviously, you know, the two things that have really affected thinking in, I think, across our society, but also particularly in the performing arts over this last year and a half are not only the obvious elephant in the room, the pandemic, but also just this idea of true diversity and inclusion, and what exactly does that mean? Fields of performing arts that are traditionally relatively undiverse, and classical music certainly is, you know, right dead center in the middle of that, have been looking particularly hard at it. There's a couple of things to come. You know, I believe very strongly the whole purpose of the Boston Pops is that this music belongs to everybody. But in classical music, you need a commitment to diversity that extends back all the way to the very roots of where people get interested in these things. I mean, one of the problems with classical music as a form that does not seem to be as diverse is that most of the people who make it to the level of the Boston Symphony, the Boston Pops, or any one of a number of high-level performing arts organizations started doing this when they were 5 or 6 years old. And they were in a household that supported that sort of activity. They were in a household that was affluent enough to support that activity. And if we really want to level the playing field out, that's where we got to start. And then, you know, a generation from now, the population on the stage will begin to resemble our greater population. And I think all of us profoundly hope that that's the case.
When we come back, Maestro Lockhart will talk about how he kept the Boston Pops family together while they were all still stuck inside. You're listening to And Another Thing on New England Public Media.
Do you enjoy language and the etymology of words? I'm Emily Brewster. Join me and my Merriam-Webster colleagues, Peter Sokolowski, Ammon Shea, and Neil Servin, as we explore the history of the English language from the dictionary's perspective on Word Matters, a new podcast from Merriam-Webster and New England Public Media, available at nepm.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am really not trying to confuse anybody here, but we are going to do another take on inflation.
If we got to a point where wages were pushing up inflation, even moderately, that's a good thing.
I'm Kai Rizdal. We will talk about why that is. We'll also have the rest of the day's business news, the numbers from Wall Street, of course, next time on Marketplace.
That's Marketplace coming up at 6:30 here on New England Public Media. The forecast for tonight, mostly clear skies with a low in the low 60s. Sunny tomorrow, becoming cloudy, a high in the mid to upper 80s. And then tomorrow night, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy otherwise, with a low in the low to mid 60s. You're listening to New England Public Media.
You're listening to And Another Thing on New England Public Media. With Maya Schrader, I'm Dara Kennedy. If you're just tuning in, we are joined by the conductor of the Boston Pops, Keith Lockhart. Under his 25-year direction, the Boston Pops has broadened its audience, performed at the NFL Super Bowl, increased touring, and even garnered the orchestra's first Grammy nominations. Putting the hiatus in perspective,
Now that you are performing again, it's between 45 and 100 musicians in every orchestra. How hard was it during the pandemic to keep the spirits up of those that you play alongside or even keep them interested in performing, not knowing when the end was going to come?
Well, it was, I mean, all of us were, you know, I think, at various levels of pretty profound depression during that period of time. We did a lot of things within the Boston Symphony family to create virtual content. We had people creating wonderful things, making music with their kids in their basement, filming them on their iPhones and sending them along. And one of the things that it did that was actually, I think, a good thing was that, you know, so traditionally, when you market an orchestra, you market the face of the conductor with a kind of blurry group of people behind them. And this is an opportunity for people who follow the Boston Symphony and the Boston Pops to really start to know other individuals in the orchestra, not just as a big mass collective. And also for those people to take some responsibility for the engagement, for the marketing of the orchestra. That was one of the things that I think a lot of people did for Sanity. They came up with their own interesting projects to do on their own. And mostly we just all kept sitting there, kept spitballing new scenarios for how we could come out of this and what we could possibly do to continue to get our product out there. And then hoping for a day like today, where at least slowly we're beginning to emerge from the cave.
Do you think there's any of those quarantine projects that are going to carry over into the after times?
I think there are lessons we learned certainly that are going to carry over into the after time. One of them is, I mean, you probably know this, the orchestral industry in particular is very, very 19th century, very analog. We don't really believe in all those newfangled things. And we've had a big lesson in how to present our product virtually and how to stream and how to do effective concerts that way, which is different than doing them to a live captive audience. And I suspect that kind of broadening of the walls of the concert hall is going to continue, that we're going to do live concerts with a lot more of those concerts being streamed simultaneously so that we are reaching people on two levels. Hopefully and primarily the people who are there in person, but also reaching a larger audience that for various reasons can't join us in person.
The streaming world is large. Additionally, that's a lot of money, right? That can also be left on the table if you don't open up kind of the digital options. And this is something I've always wondered about. How do orchestras make money? Because they are so expensive to run. How are you funded? How do you maintain that funding?
Well, you know, if I could tell you how orchestras make money, I'd be a rich man. I would say that, you know, that one of the things, and this is something people probably don't think about a lot, we make money from, excuse my terminology, butts and seats. We make money by selling tickets for people to experience a live arts event, to experience art actually happening. Because when you think about it, if you really want to see a great videotaped performance of Beethoven Eroica, for instance, you can go on YouTube and there are like, you know, 10 of them right there. And you can, you can mirror that up onto your big screen TV and your sense around sound. But that is not what classical performance is about. It's about coming together and experiencing, having an emotional journey together, the audience and the performers. So one of the things that the last year and a half made abundantly clear is that there really is no model forward for these large performing arts groups. And you're right, orchestras and opera companies are the most expensive of those without live performance. What we do need to do is find a way to monetize to some extent the online portion, which we largely did mostly as a way to keep ourselves reaching out and not because it really changed the coffers a whole lot.
The Boston Pops and the Boston Symphony are both legendary orchestras, but do you ever feel like people in the classical world view the Pops as kind of, I don't know how to put this, but less than or lighter and fluffier than the more substantial, perhaps, Boston Symphony?
There are always people who do that. I mean, from the very time I've been in the industry, when I came to this job and they started courting me, which is, you know, getting close to 30 years ago now. You know, I had people coming up to me and grabbing my arm and saying, don't do it. Don't go to the dark side of the force. I don't believe that because I believe that these concerts and this kind of orchestras are the ones that connect with people who don't consider themselves to be in that rather small group of specifically classical music fans. I do think that that attitude is changing a lot in our industry. I think there has been a lot more attempt by even more traditional symphonic ensembles to reach out and find common ground with the wider audience. You think about, you know, all the live films with concerts that have been done with orchestra that have been done recently by orchestras all over the country and all over the world. There's a lot of trying to make a common ground with a wider audience. So I think we'll see more and more that looks more like crossover and less that looks like, you know, they stay in their temple and we're out in the world.
If you're just joining us, our Monday conversation today is with none other than Maestro Keith Lockhart, who is back at Tanglewood with the Boston Pops this year. We were curious who he's listening to these days and also what the future holds.
Who are your favorite up-and-coming musicians who you're excited about right now?
Well, one of them I just worked with on the 4th of July, actually. Our big marquee star on the 4th of July concert was John Batiste, music director of the Colbert Show, and the guy whose piano playing and artistry was memorialized in the movie Soul that came out in the middle of the pandemic and raised a lot of our spirits. He's just one of the, it's hard to describe how talented he is in so many different directions. But somebody like that, who's a real true serious jazz artist and has incredible piano chops, but also obviously is very much out there in the popular music world, if that's the kind of person we need to really bridge the gap and, you know, and create a new audience for really, really high level musical expression.
So what is next? It's been 25, 26 years with the Boston Pops. Are you looking to beat Arthur Fiedler's record?
Nope. I can't imagine doing anything for 50 straight years. That sounds neither good for the person nor for the institution. I'm really want to be here until the point that either the organization doesn't feel that I have anything to give them or I don't feel that I have anything new to give the organization. I certainly am not feeling any of those pulls yet, though. I love the job, and I really, right now, it's almost, I think, for all of us who are kind of in established positions, it's kind of our job right now to put everything back on a firm footing, you know. So certainly COVID has dictated that I won't be going anywhere soon because we've got to right the ship.
So with Tanglewood now and these festivals opening, what can audiences expect from you?
I think a renewed thrill in the concept of making music live, a renewed connectivity with the audience. The audiences we've seen here and elsewhere that I've been in these last few weeks of live performances have been so hungry to connect with us. And that's something that we need to take advantage of and really reach right back out and connect with them. So I think they can look forward to really a renewed thrill in the art of live performance.
What has been your most memorable performance moment over your career?
Well, you know, up until recently, I would have said that my most memorable moment was some huge, either huge public event or some hugely important for me musical experience. And what comes to mind with those are things like, well, you know, my first 4th of July when I first saw 500,000 people in, what was it, 2012, I was the conductor at the center of the concert on the Buckingham Palace grounds for the Diamond Jubilee of Queen Elizabeth. That was broadcast to like billions of people. Those were great. Some great moments with big Mahler symphonies and things like that, but those are more personal. But I would say that some of my now most memorable experiences are the ones that took place 3-4 weeks ago, because it was such an amazing renewal to go out on stage and hear a live audience respond and to play music and hear a live audience respond. So some of the concerts I did in the early part of July, which were the first concerts in which I'd seen a live audience since March 12th of 2020, I think will always remain as some of my most satisfying moments.
Maestro Keith Lockhart, thank you so much for joining us on And Another Thing. It was wonderful to speak with you.
Hey, thank you very much, and appreciate it. Come out and hear us here sometime.
Thanks for joining us today. I'm Derek Kennedy. If you'd like to leave us a comment, call us at 800-639-9120.
You can find us on social media at Hello and Another, or email us at andanotherthing@nepm.org. I'm Maya Schwader. Thanks for listening, and have a great evening.